Go. There went out a request from one of our she-wolves, or maybe a he-wolf, for a she-wolf song here on Freya's Day. Frankie Valli, How Much He Adores You. Yeah, there you go. That ought to get you someplace if you go out tonight. And yeah, that ought to get you someplace. White Area and Resistance Radio Network calling. White Area and Resistance Radio Network calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, right here in the bunker on, it's the April the 10th, 2015, Freya's Day in the bunker. That's right. And we got, looks like a pretty nice day. The wind got really howling last night, but no damage around here. We're all set up here. We don't worry about anything. But they really racked up Fairview or Fair Dawn or Fair something over there in Illinois. Flattened that damn thing out. Tornadoes. We haven't had a tornado around here since I was about 16 years old. And then it didn't hit the town and didn't do hardly any damage. But I learned right then that there's something about churches that God don't like. Because the only damage around here in that tornado was that the tornado wiped a church out. Came right down on top of that church, hit that church, threw it all over the county, and then it went back up. Didn't bother anybody else. And they never hit a bar. Tornadoes very rarely ever hit a bar. But just last week, remember, the roof fell in on the church back east? I'm telling you. I think there's a message going out there from our pagan, more powerful gods. Don't like those churches, the churches, man. The whole hurt 14 people. Luckily, they weren't killed. Yeah. So anyhow, that's my thought for the day. Well, I see the dummies up in Washington that are trying their best to serve capitalism all the time. And they get their panties twisted around, and they're screwing up the meeting for the meeting of the South American countries, and they're screwing that up real good because the South American countries ain't going to take Washington's crap anymore. You know, the capitalistas in Washington, had things all totally under control for a long, long time in South America, but the South American countries are beginning to say, bullshit, we don't want your capitalist dictators down here, and we're going to have our say too. So anyhow, they're sort of saying, we're not going to be your backyard anymore. That's right. So I don't blame them. This empire thing is ridiculous. Pushing people around all over the world, and people are going to start pushing back. In fact, they've been pushing back for a while, and I don't think you've seen anything yet. The pushback's going to get pretty wild, pretty wild. You know, we had that School of the Americas down there in, Georgia, where we trained all these hitmen, military hitmen, to go throughout South America and knock off governments and install dictators. They got a long memory down there, man. Long memory. And I don't blame them. The old hardliners up there in Washington, they want to stay with this anti-Cuba situation, too, which is ridiculous. That should have been dropped a long time ago. That was, we're dealing with the biggest communist country in the world. They make the excuse of communism, but that's BS. It's BS. It's the money deal. No matter how they can arrange it, they're going to make the money. So, but Cuba, you're dealing with China, shipping all our jobs to China. Why in the hell, if they're going to ship, why didn't they ship a lot of those plants to Cuba? Then they'd be only 90 miles away from the United States. The shipping costs would be low and so forth. Ah, shit. It's such a screwed up deal. You know it is. I know it is. And as usual, we're right here at P.O. Box 401. It's getting harder for me to squeeze into it, but I'm here. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your goodies and your donations for the show and so forth. Yeah, that's right. And don't forget to send me comments on the show or whatever else, your own ideas along those lines. I think that's very important to know what you're thinking out there. Well, I think we're going to go back into The Man Called Lucy this morning. You may hear it in the afternoon, I don't know. But anyhow, The Man Called Lucy, who ran the spy ring out of Switzerland, that did as much as anybody else to bring Hitler down, bring Germany to its knees. It was 10 high-ranking officers in the Central Command of in Berlin that were feeding Rosner, alias Lucy, all during the war. I mean, really, Third Reich was on the ropes before it even started. Now, one thing for sure, like I've read to you and talked to you about, all those countries, including England, all the Low Countries, were not listening to Rosner when he sent them the plans to exactly what Hitler was going to do. They didn't get prepared or anything. Now, if they had jumped right on it and got prepared, they probably still couldn't have stopped the Blitzkrieg, but they could have torn the hell out of the German army. They could have really slowed them down. And at that point, Hitler may have decided not to go into Barbarossa and go into Russia. But these countries didn't do anything. They left it wide open for him. He came marching right through with almost no resistance at all. One of the reasons I like to talk to you about this is because there's so much Hitler worship in the right wing, and it shouldn't be done. I think we should certainly respect all the soldiers and sailors and airmen that died for what they thought was their country, and to point out the bravery of all these people, and like that. But it was a clusterfuck from the beginning. Now Hitler, I'm not going to say he was stupid. He's probably a pretty smart guy, but he was such a narcissist. He didn't seem to realize that once he went into the Russian deal and the whole bit, England's all of their colonies with their massive raw materials are going to come out of the woodwork like mad. While Germany is going to have to fight with one hand behind them, they're going to have to fight, number one, for raw materials while they're fighting the war. Whereas and then the United States came into it, Hitler had to have known with the vast amount of natural resources, because that's what usually wins a war. It's not as much the military as your proximity to tremendous amounts of natural items like iron and iron ore, copper ore, all that stuff, oil. You know, even at the end of the war, the one general said, you know, they said, well, what happened? He said, I ran out of oil. They had still had tremendous amounts of armored, but they ran out of oil. So the whole World War II thing, from someone looking at the German point of view, will be able to easily see it was a fiasco. And they might have lasted longer, but they would never have won, couldn't have won. But here is this guy down in Switzerland going crazy because nobody's listening to him. He gives all these countries all the battle plans, everything else, and they don't listen to him. And so a lot of the people that were in his spy ring were almost ready to throw up their hands. Forget it. And then the Russians took them weeks, maybe months, to believe that Rosner was giving them the straight scoop. He was giving them all the war plans right from the headquarters in Berlin. And they were so suspicious, they didn't accept it. But once they did start accepting it, and had the fanatical zeal of the Red Army, no matter if they lost millions of people rounded up and put into captivity, but still they would have won in the end because they had unlimited geography to retreat to. That's a big-ass country, Ben. And the war could have gone on for 20 years. Yeah. Reminds me of the Civil War here, where Lee surrenders, and Jefferson Davis said, what the hell's going on here? Let's fight a guerrilla war. And eventually we'll beat him. But he got overruled. And a guerrilla war the whole war should have been fought on a guerrilla basis, but how can you get capitalist plantation owners to agree to that? They want big armies with nice uniforms and badges and everything to march abreast right into the enemy's cannons. And if they can't win that way, well, they just give up. But even at the, like I say, even at the end of the Civil War, if the South, that had still plenty of fight left in them, could have gone to guerrilla warfare and might not made any deals, the North would be getting tired of the war. They wanted the war to end. So anyhow, I'm going to go back to the man called Lucy, and we'll see some more of why Mr. Hitler couldn't win. And the biggest crime that Hitler committed was when he could see the handwriting on the wall. I mean, it was over in May, what, 43? Latest 44, he didn't throw in the towel and save his country from being wiped out. And millions of people dying in Germany. Which shows how he was. And whether it was the drugs or his own narcissism or what. But anyhow, I do want to get this World War II stuff out of the way, and we've got plenty of things that are happening right now we need to pay attention to. But I think before we can really have any kind of an idea about some type of a united front, we've got to get the people who have brains enough to get out of misreading World War II and get them into a different situation. That's my situation. Before Schellenberg embarked on his personal mission, the ground had been well prepared. In fact, the coverage of Switzerland by the German espionage services was more concentrated and more active than in any other country in the world. Well, so what? It had begun as early as 1937, as if the Reich had guessed in advance that any internal opposition to Nazism would turn first to Switzerland, a fellow German-speaking state, for refuge. The German infiltration of Switzerland was entrusted to two organizations, the Abwehr, the Wehrmacht's espionage, counter-espionage, and sabotage service under Admiral Canaris, who was a traitor, who was an agent of the West, and the SD of Himmler and Schellenberg. Now, Schellenberg was pretty close to a genius. If they'd had him in a really high position, he could have done some good early in a war. By the time Schellenberg was appointed, it was almost too late. Together, the two organizations had established branches in Stuttgart, 75 miles to the north of the Confederation, which would deal specifically with Switzerland. Stuttgart, that was an American armored division town. Been there many times. Lieutenant Colonel Zeitz, also Stuttgart was, I believe it was Stuttgart where there was a major race riot back in the 50s between the blacks and the whites. People were killed. I'm telling you, it was a big riot. Lieutenant Colonel Zeitz had been placed in charge of the Abwehr office. Lieutenant Colonel Schmidt, specializing in military matters, was kept constantly informed about the Swiss Army. His colleague, Major Gehler, had an up-to-date and detailed picture of the Swiss economy, and Baron von Stauffenberg, you know, that's the guy that plotted to kill Hitler, alias Uncle Frank, was in charge of the espionage network itself. He was to send out more than 1,000 agents who infiltrated the Swiss industrial and political circles. Well, that's cool as hell, but you can't even ferret out the 10 guys in your high command that are ratting you out. Major Hyland armed these spies and supplied them with money, false identification, radios, special links, and cameras. Captain Fretznik, known to his colleagues as Marconi, was in charge of the transmitter receive station at Sigmaringen, which was to be used by the organizations covering Switzerland. Four advanced posts at Lorach, Sackingen, Constance, and Bregenz directed activity near the Swiss frontier. If they'd have concentrated that much into agents pouring them into the United States and England, they might have had a chance. But there was virtually none of that going on. There was almost none of it going on. There was no sabotage to speak of in the United States at all, or England. The office of the SD in Stuttgart had 20,000 files on Swiss citizens who could be used. It trained 300 agents every 6 months, who were then sent into Switzerland to recruit their accomplices. Germans living in the Confederation and naturalized Swiss, or Papier Schweizer, were approached first. Frontiersmen of double nationality were also chosen for indoctrination. The action of the SD was of a political nature. Well, the first guy that was approached that was, patriotic to Switzerland would have sounded the alarm. From then on, that wouldn't be very effective at all. When a practical operation was required, the SD called in Heinrich Müller's Gestapo or Otto Skorzeny's Jagdkommando. It was the latter that undertook the first hostile action against Switzerland in 1940. Only the persistency of a Swiss railway worker on Sunday, June 16th, prevented the attempt from taking place. He was inspecting tickets on the Romanshorn Zurich train when he noticed something that struck him as curious. 10 passengers who had boarded at Weinfelden had taken up seats in 2 carriages, carried identical brown canvas suitcases. Suspicious of this coincidence, he informed the police at Marstenatten, the next stop. Meanwhile, alarmed by the resistance with which he had observed them, the 10 men jumped from the train. A search was set up, and 2 days later, 9 of them were captured, 7 Germans and 2 Swiss. Each possessed 500 Swiss francs, about $115 at the time. An infernal machine loaded with 5.5 pounds of TNT, a supply of food, tools, a Luger 9mm, revolver and 40 cartridges, and a dagger. They were assigned to blow up the ammunition depot at Altdorf in the canton of Uri and sabotaged the runways of the military airfields in Lausanne, Payerne, Bern, and Spritzenbach, an operation ordered by Hermann Göring as a reprisal for 4 German fighters shot down by anti-aircraft guns while flying over Swiss territory. On November 16, 1940, the 9 agents were given life sentences. The 10th had succeeded in escaping. Baron von Stauffenberg, the head of the action section of the Abwehr in Stuttgart, had greater success in his first assault on Switzerland. At dawn on September 4, 1940, a convoy of cars bearing the emblem of the Red Cross stopped near La Villette, Viaduct, and Haute Savary, over which the Annecy Law, I know I'm murdering these words, Roxfer and Foron Railway crossed the ravine. The first car appeared to have stalled. The men were busy under the hood. Meanwhile, another group fixed 176 pounds of melanite under one of the pillars of the bridge. The convoy moved on. Some hours later, the bridge collapsed. This bridge was of great value to Switzerland since the destruction of the railway at Pontarlier, the tunnel in Fresnay, and the fine construction of the Bellegarde-Geneva line. Switzerland had relied on it for the transportation of overseas supplies. For 2 months, the Swiss had to depend on a shuttle service of trucks between Annecy and Geneva to link them with the free world. You see, that neutrality bit was paper thin as far as Switzerland was concerned on both sides. The missions of the Abwehr and the SD against Switzerland ran into thousands. A scale of payment was drawn up, 1,000 Swiss francs for the empty shell of an anti-tank grenade, $1,500 francs if it was full. Reports on National Defense Program, 1,500, with photographs, 2,000. Weapons or new projectiles, up to 50,000, was paid. This had already enabled the OKW to publish in 1940 a small volume of 85 pages entitled Handbook of the Swiss Army, intended for use of German troops in the event of a possible invasion of the country. To cross Swiss borders, the Germans used two techniques. A few hundred yards away from the chosen crossing point, they would create a diversion, firing shots as if pursuit of somebody. This would draw the attention of the customs officers and frontier guards and leave the field clear for the spies. Passersby who hid them were paid $225 per agent. The second method was safer but more expensive, 1,500 francs, $350. The crossing took place in the Basel railway station. The German customs officers would take the spies, disguised as railway workers, across the lines and hand them over to their Swiss accomplices. Basel Station, an international junction between Switzerland, Germany, and France, was swarming with more spies throughout the war than perhaps any other single place in the world. Colonel Jacquelaird, head of the Swiss counter-espionage, was to count with amazing 350 known German spies on the nights of May 14th and 15th, 1940, alone. They were sitting quietly on the German side of the border, awaiting the best time to slip into Switzerland. Throughout the war, the SD never ceased its effort to win the Swiss over to Nazism. Its Bureau F in Bern, concealed in the German legation and directed by the Consul General Hans Meissner, served as a cell for recruitment and subversion. It included a group of well-trained specialists who, like Meissner, benefited from their diplomatic immunity. By the middle of 1942, the number of Germans living in Switzerland had assumed almost the proportions of a state within a state. Brigadier Meissner did not underestimate the gravity of this situation. He often exceeded his annual budget of 50 million Swiss francs, about 12 million bucks, without causing too much opposition, but the means at his disposal in terms of men and money were hardly adequate to withstand the Nazi tide. He congratulated himself for having persuaded the local police forces as early as 1938 to keep a special register of foreign residents in every locality. For each name in this register, there was an arrest warrant made out in advance. At the slightest sign of suspicion, his agents struck. Between 1939 and 42, they had followed up on no fewer than 1,000 leads. Of course, not all of these turned up to be German spies, and occasionally an innocent person was incriminated. By the middle of 42, however, Meissner's service had become so efficient that the best spies began to fall into their nets. The Germans never gave their agents more than 3 months' activity in Switzerland, which led them to change their tactics. Since their network seemed to be short-lived, they resolved to practice the technique of inundation. If one agent disappeared, he would be replaced by five. To this, the Swiss replied by increasing the severity of their penalties. Espionage had not previously been treated very harshly by the federal courts. They had often been content to expel the undesirables. Now the courts were ordered by the federal consul to act ruthlessly. More than 1,500 spies, including 50 women, were charged with activities against the security of the Swiss state. 202 were given sentences of between 5 and 15 years. You know how history glosses over all this, you know? I never heard of all this type of activity in Switzerland. I assumed there was some, but there was a tremendous amount. Among them were 64 Germans, 16 citizens of Liechtenstein, and 164 Swiss. 33 spies were given life in prison, and 19 were condemned to death, 16 of these being executed. I never read that. This, then, was the situation in Switzerland as Schellenberg struggled to work out a new, more subtle, and more profitable way of tackling the Swiss. Well, as far as being strategically, and Switzerland was very important, Hitler should have taken it right away. He should have just taken it over. In fact, Schellenberg had decided to aim high at Brigadier Roger Messon himself. A year and a half earlier, on Schellenberg's orders, SS Sturmbannerfuhrer H.W. Eggen began to prepare the ground. Eggen, an executive of the Wehren tribe, the GmbH, a large industrial group in Berlin, also had considerable financial interests in Luzon. When given the job of supplying the Wehrmacht with huts in 1940, Eggen had approached two representatives of the Swiss timber industry, Paul Holzack and P. Mayer, and had succeeded in building up close relations with them. His choice of Mayer and Holzack had been deliberate. Before meeting them, Eggen knew that both businessmen had been mobilized into the Swiss forces as captains and were among Messon's closest, most trusted colleagues. At Eggen's repeated request, Mayer decided to introduce him to Roger Messon. They met on Wednesday, December 10th, 1941, during one of Eggen's many business trips. They discussed relations between Switzerland and the Third Reich, Messon complaining of the virulence of the attacks on his country by the German press. Eggen assured him that this problem could certainly be resolved. Eggen suggested that Messon be put into contact with his friend, superior and spiritual master, SS Brigadier Schellenberg, who had influenced the highest quarters. Mason did not regard such a meeting as very pressing and declined the offer. Meanwhile, on the Eastern Front, artillery had opened fire once more. For 4 hours, the Russian lines had been shelled in preparation for the launching of Operation Blue, which it was hoped would be the Wehrmacht's final victorious onslaught on the Red Army. Hitler had long hesitated to give the green light to his troop commanders, Field Marshal von Bock and General Friedrich Paulus. A Fiesele Storch, a small reconnaissance plane, had been shot down 8 days before in a sector held by the Russians, east of Kharkov, near the banks of the Oskol. In the plane had been an officer of the 23rd Tank Division, Major Reichel. Reichel's briefcase had contained notes and maps indicating the positions of the divisions and the objectives of the entire 40th Tank Corps. So they weren't getting all their information from Rossner. Field Marshal Keitel had cautiously suggested to the Führer that the offensive be delayed, as the Russians were obviously now in possession of a large part of the Wehrmacht's plans. Von Bock and Paulus protested. Quote, even if the Russians do have the plans of the 40th Corps, which is not yet certain, they haven't time to arrange their defenses accordingly. Moreover, the 40th Corps will only cover part of the front. The rest of the plans remain strictly secret. Delay our enterprise now and it will never have a chance of success. It will be winter before we have attained our objective. Well, that's true. They were right about that. Despite the lesson of Moscow, Hitler seems to have followed Keitel's advice in hopes, perhaps, that his scientists working under Wernher von Braun would soon provide him with their super rockets, rockets capable of subjugating the world. You know, you got to put a lot of confidence in technology, but if you put too much confidence in technology, it can be a trap. But of course, the Russians knew not only the plans of the 40th Armored Corps, though apparently they had found nothing in the wreckage of the Fiesele Storch plane. They also had full details of Operation Blue, which was basically the directive number 41 sent out by Hitler in April. Rudolf Rossler had provided them. Despite his dexterity achieved by endless practice in the service of the Russians, Alexander Foote had great difficulty in communicating this enormous pile of coded dispatches to the center. He spent 5 hours nightly in coding alone, and his difficulties were increased by the frequent shifts in coding ordered by Moscow. Then, from 1 a.m. onward, the silence of his room was broken only by the remorseless tapping of his Morse code key. With the windows carefully sealed to prevent any light leakage, he works steadily until dawn, the air becoming murky from the smoke of his innumerable cigarettes. Rudolf Roessler had communicated his dedication to Radau's entire network. Foote was no longer able to cope with the sheer quantity of Lucy's messages. And Margarita Bulli and Edmund Hemmel were assigned the transmission of the WYRDO dispatches, or messages of top priority, coming right from the German high command. There was a particular reason for the sudden increase in their work volume. For the first time since they had begun to use Lucy's exceptional services, the Russians had made radical changes in their strategy. Until then, they had been content, thanks to advanced intelligence from Switzerland, to make perfect estimates of the enemy's forces and plans. But when the actual battles took place, they ignored the further use to which Lucy's dispatches could be put, and fought according to academic rules taught to them by their instructions in the Black Reichsphere. Fully aware of the fate that awaited them, they allowed themselves almost fatalistically to meet the enemy on the ground at the times determined by the Germans. An analysis of the tactics used during the first year of the conflict reveals that although the Russians knew exactly what the Germans planned to do, they consistently allowed themselves to be encircled and pinned down. However, from 1942, things were to go differently. The Red Army began to elude the Wehrmacht. It learned to evade all the pincer movements that had worked so successfully before. It continued to attack and defend from a frontal position, but suddenly adopted tactics involving great mobility, drawing the German troops into terrain unsuited to the broad formations required by armored divisions. Now the Red Army seized the initiative. And of course, remember, they had all the plans of the German high command in their hands when they did this stuff. Now they set the times and the places for battles. Moreover, it was the Russians who introduced a new weapon into the conflict: psychological warfare, a barrage of information and threats. The Second Hungarian Army was its first victim. In the middle of the night, voices amplified by powerful speakers just within the Russian lines announced, quote, "Hungarians, we know that tomorrow at dawn you will cross the Oskol, but we shall not be there to meet you. We shall meet when and where we wish. You will then be sorry you ever came to Russia. You will curse your leaders for having given in to Field Marshal Keitel and agreeing to send you here," unquote. That must have been really turned a bunch pole if you heard it and you were waiting out there to fight the Russians. The 23rd Tank Division, which had only just arrived on the Eastern Front from France, was greeted. Quote, "Soldiers of the 23rd, welcome to the Soviet Union. Your fine Paris days are over now. What awaits you in our country will far surpass anything your comrades who were frostbitten may have told you, but you will see for yourselves before long," unquote. The 24th Tank Division was received at midnight warning, quote, "Panzer Grenadiers of the 24th, we shall not be south of Voronezh the day after tomorrow, as your leaders have assured you. You needn't try to encircle us. We won't be there. Save your bread, your ammunition, and your gasoline, for we are going to besiege you. The luckiest will be those who have kept a bullet to blow their own brains out," unquote. How would that make you feel if you were in a German front, a German soldier? Here was Lucy's intelligence at its most effective. While, of course, it could never be traced back to the source, its devastating results appeared in a great many of the German soldiers' accounts of the campaign. The same anxiety recurs everywhere, an anxiety found in descriptions of the action on no other front. These fighting men got the disastrous impression that the enemy had access to the plans of their chiefs, which they did. They were paralyzed by a feeling that the Red Terror had engulfed them in the middle of barren steppes. The Russians' first attempt at putting Lucy's vital intelligence to work as ammunition where the psychological warfare was an unqualified success. Its impact on the ordinary soldiers was particularly devastating, and many suffered complete mental breakdowns. The officers of the Wehrmacht tended to ridicule it, but in a sense were even more intensely affected, since they realized that the Russians must possess other, much more valuable intelligence than they did not broadcast over their loudspeakers, but which would enable them to subvert completely the usual tactics of the OKW at the front. None of them, however, dared suppose that the source of these terrifying revelations was in Berlin High Command itself. These mid-months of 1942 also marked a new stage for Roger Mason and the Bureau HA in their relations with Roessler, codenamed Lucy. They felt that he had changed, and the change was not to their liking. When they had begun to use him in 1939, their attitude was not without a certain condescension. By some extraordinary chance, they thought this emigre had access to a source of intelligence whose importance he did not himself appear to realize. So they used him for their own ends, then in the interests of the Western Allies, who they believed held the same ideals. When Roessler announced that he also wanted to work for the Russians, who had now joined the Allies, they turned a blind eye, fully expecting that it would not amount to very much. With the first great Russian victories, his victories, he had, by irritating habit of calling them, Roessler seemed to become a bigger person, or simply to reveal his true nature. He may not have been interested in money, but he seemed strangely exalted by the sense of power and pride. This new Roessler, now revealed as the real head of his resistance network, suddenly became dangerous. However, he continued to fulfill the conditions agreed between them, making no attempt to conceal from the Swiss the intelligence he passed on to the Russians. But Masson and the Bureau HA now realized that by means of his intelligence, Roessler would play an overwhelming role in the victory of the Russians in the East. If by some misfortune the Germans discovered that it was Switzerland who had made this possible, then the neutrality of the Confederation would be in jeopardy. The very existence of Switzerland as an independent state might be in danger. You better believe it. Hitler could come roaring in there and take it over the damn place, which he should have done anyhow. I mean, looking at it from Hitler's point of view. From then on, few men were to be as closely guarded as Roessler. Night and day, the Vita Nova Verlag in Flumastrasse in Lucerne and his home at Wesemelien were watched by shadowy, scrupulous, discreet figures. If Roessler was aware of them, he did not reveal it. He expressed no gratitude for his protection. This irritated the Swiss. They watched over him, but at the same time they began to try to discover more about his activities devoted to the Russians. One particularly warm night at the end of the summer 1942, the radio operator at Geneva Airport was feeling bored. The Swiss Air Force that patrolled the skies to intercept overflights and thus preserve Swiss neutrality made no flights after nightfall, but the authorities insisted that someone remain at the radio controls throughout the night. After wandering aimlessly around his office, the operator sat down at his instruments and began to play idly with the knobs. Suddenly, he intercepted a broadcast on a wavelength that was not used by the Swiss Armed Forces. The letters and figures appeared in groups of five, and the uncertain touch marked the sender as an amateur. Failing to decipher the message, the operator informed BUPO, the Swiss counter-espionage service. He had carefully noted that the wavelength and the time of the broadcast. The clandestine transmitter definitely lay quite near the airport, probably in Geneva itself, for throughout the transmission its tone had been extremely sharp and clear. Moreover, its transmission strength meant that the set was used by the local electrical supply, not batteries. The following night, three vans equipped with gonias awaited near, gonias are these loop antennas that are on top of the vans when they're looking for a transmitter. Awaited near the airport and picked up some of the transmission. It was coming from the southeast, setting out slowly from three different points, guided by the sound that gradually converged on a point in the center of Geneva. When the tapping stopped at almost the same time as it had previously not on the previous night, the vans had already crossed the bridges of the Rhone River. The next night they got even closer to the clandestine transmitter. One of the genios was near the university and the second was in the Rue Rosenex, beside the Jardin Anglais, and the third near the Parc de la Grange. On the fourth day of the search, they intercepted a new transmitter in the same area, manipulated by an amateur even clumsier than the first. Then they lost touch with the broadcast altogether. A week later, the Gonios vans were stationed in the Route des Florissants at the gates of the Parc Alfred Bertrand when the tapping recommenced. This time it was so strong that the technicians were certain the operator was somewhere in that street. A single gonio, manned with BUPO agents, did the final work of tracking him down. To pinpoint the house, they used a trick invented by the Germans. The electric current of each house was cut in turn, just long enough for an agent to walk from one to the next. There's something for you to remember. If the broadcast continued, then the secret operator was not in the house in front of which they were passing. In this way, they eventually focused on number 192, Route des Florissants. The same method located the second transmitter at 8 BIS, Rue Henri Masson. It was now child's play for Masson's department to match the names of the street numbers. Both were on the list of suspected persons, because both belonged to the Swiss Communist Party, Edward Hamel and Margarita Bolli. A Swiss coding expert, Marc Piot, dutifully set to work to break the cryptic dispatches recorded since the discovery of these transmissions. Now, you got to remember that this kind of work was very important. It could mean the deaths of tens of thousands of soldiers in the field, just having these radio transmitters around sending the intelligence information on both sides. That's why communications is very, very, very important. Masson was less interested in what the communists might be communicating than in the fact that they had continuous relations with a correspondent outside the Confederation. It seemed obvious that this could only be Moscow, and that Hamel and Bolli must be Rossler's radio-telegraph operators. The couple were carefully watched, and the results confirmed the theory. Both Hamel and Bolli often visited a certain Alexander Radau, who also received in his geo press offices one Christian Schneider, a close friend of Rudolf Rossler, Lucy. Of course, these discoveries came as a great relief to Masson and the Bureau. If the need arose, they at last had a way of blocking the work of this frighteningly effective agent. They could destroy him as easily as defend him. The reason for Masson's sudden mistrust of Rossler was due not to any real change in the intelligence that Rossler received, but rather in the use to which it was being put by the Russians. But to understand Swiss fears at the time, it was necessary to review events taking place on the Eastern Front. On July 1st, 1942, the Wehrmacht began advancing from its positions won in May. Its first objective was Voronezh, both an economic and industrial center, and a road and rail junction. The Germans intended to make the Voronezh the fortress that would cover the Wehrmacht's offensive on its north flank. Three Germans and one Hungarian army would cross the Oskol with General Haas' tanks as they spearhead. Disconcertingly, the six Soviet armies under Semyon Kontanovich Tymchenko, boy, these names are something else, which the German troops had expected to encircle from the north and the south, had disappeared without engaging battle, and it was not certain which direction they had taken. Where the hell did Ivan go? He's supposed to be here. Feeling that their attack had now been inexplicably blunted, the Wehrmacht officers wished to abandon Operation Blue entirely and pursue the Red Army on a wide front in the direction of the Don. Hitler refused. They must first encircle the Russians. Now, there's a problem with here. Hitler back there in Berlin. He's not a really high-trained military guy. He's a corporal in the First World War. These are professional, hard-nosed generals. They're pretty damn smart. And he keeps getting involved in second-guessing his generals all the time. I mean, they had done very well with this type of attitude before, on a wide front, just going for the gold, you know. But now he's telling them, no, keep trying to encircle them. And the Russians already had all the intelligence of what he was doing. Terrified in advance of leaving the initiative to his high command, the Führer stuck obstinately to his own plans. Duh! On July 3rd, General Haas' 4th Army and Friedrich Paulus' 6th Army rendezvoused his plan, but there was nothing there. So they wasted all that time, energy, gasoline, and oil for nothing. Meanwhile, they could have been halfway to Moscow. The huge net they had spread was empty. Hitler realized that the Russians had outwitted him. On a lightning visit to von Bock's headquarters, he raged. Quote, I'm not interested in Voronezh anymore. Go south and get to Stalingrad. Which was another stupid thing, to waste all that time, money, and troops, and a million troops on Stalingrad. He could have been in Moscow sipping vodka. He did not say that he did not want Voronezh, completely baffled and fearing that he might be reproached later for not following directive number 41 to the letter. Von Bock temporized without knowing it. He was being lured by Timoshenko, who had allowed the 24th Tank Division to forge on unopposed to the within a few miles of Voronezh. The Germans had no way of knowing how Timoshenko was able to keep fully informed as to their doubts, expectations, and troop movements. In fact, you see, Hitler's generals were all scared to death of Hitler. Sort of like the ones, Stalin's generals. I mean, if you said the wrong thing, he'd execute you, call you a traitor, you're gone. You can't run a railroad like that. In fact, during this period, which lasted for more than a month, scarcely 10 hours elapsed between the making of the decision by the OKW and its reception by Moscow. On one occasion, the interval was even reduced to 6 hours. Roessler had correctly calculated that speed in transmission of intelligence was vital. This alone would enable the Kremlin to develop a strategy which, in the course of a decisive battle, could turn the war in their favor. Consequently, he called on 10 agents of the Werther and Olga in Berlin to drive themselves even harder to satisfy his insatiable appetite for information. And the Russians never had occasion to ask Lucy to accelerate the supply of intelligence because they were feeding it to him like mad. And why, how come Schellenberg wasn't put in charge of ferreting out these traitors in the German high command in Berlin instead of putting him out on all this other bullshit? I mean, it's right under Hitler's nose all this information is going out. And they had to use a telexes. And it wouldn't be hard to find out who it was because there was only a certain number of people in the high command had any kind of access to the telexes. You had to have a super clearance for that. And he gave all the rats the clearance. rats, it depends on how you look at it. I don't know. On July 4th, von Bock believed that he could take Voronezh. In a surprise attack, he remained convinced that Timoshenko's troops could only have escaped from their trap by going south and north, and that they had not yet crossed the Don. After all, he reasoned, the bridges were intact. It did not occur to him for a moment that this might be a trap. And what's happening to the attack in the south, Hitler asked. Contingents of the 24th Division are already entering the outskirts of the city. The Russians are fleeing, unquote, von Bloch replied. This time it was Hitler himself who plunged into the trap. He ordered the troops to split up. About half, including the 6th Army, would set out for Stalingrad in the south, but they would make no attempts to take the city, their mission being to bypass the Soviet armies, which Voronezh occupied. Von Bock was to continue straight on and link up with Paulus. This time the Russians would not escape their net. The second branch of the Pincer movement would simply arrive slightly later than the first. On receiving this news from Lucy, Timoshenko was exultant. The Germans were making a disastrous mistake in dividing their forces. In fact, the full use of which the information from the Wehrmacht and Olga, the spy group, was being put enabled the Soviet high command to work out a system of foolproof tactics, break the strike force of the Wehrmacht, then lure a large body of troops into the cul-de-sac where they could be wiped out. Meanwhile, the second body of troops was to be engaged in a place suitable for prolonged combat, thus preventing it from rescuing the first column and linking up with another group of armies that would be difficult to defeat. The cul-de-sac would be Stalingrad and the battlefield Voronezh. A stupid deal of getting bogged down in Stalingrad. In answer to the Operation Blue, therefore, Timoshenko, like von Bock, divided his forces, but they were more numerous and better supplied with fuel than the Germans because they held the railways. So the majority of Soviet troops awaited the advance of Paulus' 6th Army, harassing it constantly and planting it down and gradually cutting it off from its rear lines. Meanwhile, the rest of the Russians under Timoshenko himself waited Voronezh, possessing far more military than von Bock expected to meet. When von Bock ordered the city to be taken, the moment of truth for the Third Reich had arrived. In their accounts, his officers were to nickname Voronezh the Cursed City. They fought their way through the suburbs only to come to a standstill in the city's center, where the outcome of the fighting never seemed clear. Withdrawal was impossible. They had advanced too far for their departure not to appear defeat. But Timoshenko did get out of the city. He left Voronezh at precisely the moment he'd planned, and without leaving a single truck behind, disappearing into the steppe. He withdrew the masses of troops that he had sent in the direction of Stalingrad to open the way for Paulus' 6th Army had reached the Volga. These troops were 18 days ahead of the Germans. Realizing one morning that Paulus was no longer following him, the general in command sent word to Moscow asking whether the Germans had changed their plans. The center alerted Foote, who passed on a message to Rössler. The incredible reply from Lucy caused much of the rejoicing among the Russians. Paulus' 6th Army had run out of gasoline and would be immobilized for 430 hours. This unexpected respite allowed future defenders of Stalingrad to reinforce their lines. What about Moscow, you dumb shits? On the Caucasian front, too, the Russians applied the new tactics, and timely warning from Switzerland enabled them to invade all the numerous attempts at encirclement made by Field Marshal Sigmund Wilhelm List. The commanding officers engaged in the Operation Blue were to discover too late that what they had interpreted as retreats were in fact concerted withdrawals which would eventually seal the fate of the Third Reich. And remember, all this time the Russian partisans were snapping at the heels of the German military. They were very effective at using really barbarous tactics on the Russian army. By the beginning of September, these officers were to realize with horror that their scattered armies separated from each other by sometimes as much as 300 miles, linked by lines of communication stretched to the snapping point, had become terribly vulnerable. Sunk in the sand of the steppe, surrounded by vast open spaces, the Wehrmacht's formidable strike force no longer existed. The Red Army, aided by the oncoming winter and the continual flow of advance intelligence from Berlin, would be able to destroy it at leisure. The situation was a brilliant success on the part of the Soviet High Command. Through his notorious inability to understand, let alone solve, large-scale strategic problems, Hitler was also an involuntary accomplice of the Russians. Quote, "They're finished. They're exhausted," he cried contentiously to General Halder, his chief of staff, who dared to convey to him the fears of his troops on the Eastern Front. Quote, "Can't you see the Russians are finished? Stalin will never be able, as you claim, to mobilize 1.5 million fresh men from Stalingrad, not to mention the 500,000 he is supposed to be launching from the Caucasus. I forbid you to go on repeating such nonsense," unquote. And if you disagree with me, I'll have you hung. He even went so far as to withdraw troops from this sector of the Russian front, sending 7 precious divisions to France via Leningrad. If then these were the most tangible results of intelligence conveyed to Stalin by Lucy, it certainly helps explain the anxiety felt by the Swiss Secret Service. Rösler and his network would have to be watched constantly. Mason would have to make it his business to ensure their protection from discovery by Nazi agents. It was the utmost importance that Hitler should learn nothing of the part played by the Confederation in this affair. Switzerland's destiny depended on it. Apparently, one man had already considered such a possibility. In Berlin, Walter Schellenberg had coldly analyzed the development of the summer's events on the Eastern Front. He alone among the leading Nazis understood the vital role of the resistance network he was trying to unmask. He's one of the great strategists. He sure was. By September 1942, the meeting which Roger Masson had so far obstinately avoided had, from Schellenberg's point of view, become most urgent. He would have to strike before this leak did any further damage to the Reich. Reinhard Heydrich had been convinced that the traitors who were informing the Russians were to be found among the officers of the Wehrmacht, and Schellenberg still believed that they were being aided by the traditional opposition to Hitler. He had thought immediately of Admiral Canaris, then the vice-consul Hans Bernd Jesevius, the head of the Abwehr's network in Switzerland. Only one person could help Schellenberg prove this theory, that the conspirators in the OKW headquarters in Berlin were also involved in the affair, Masson. This was why he had to meet him. He did not, of course, hope to find an ally. Rather, he intended to strangle Switzerland in a tight net of obligations. And he did not lack the proper bait. Only when he left that Masson had been securely hooked would he reveal his true intentions. If the Swiss really were unaware of this affair, which was still conceivable, then Schellenberg would quite simply ask for their help in destroying these enemies of Nazism. However, Schellenberg lacked one thing. He would have liked to have entered this power struggle with an ace up his sleeve. Unwittingly, Mason had was to present him with such a card. Among the dispatches concerning Switzerland that reached him twice a week from the office of the SD in Stuttgart, Schellenberg found a piece of information which, although apparently innocent enough, immediately set him scheming. A young Swiss officer, Lieutenant Morgiella, had just arrived in Stuttgart, a new clerk in the chancellery of the Swiss consulate. It was his first post. Having him watched would be ridiculously easy, for it is well known that the employees of embassies and consulates were often used to carry out information missions. An hour later, Schellenberg telephoned SS Sturmbannerfuhrer Hugel, the head of the Stuttgart office, and ordered him to mount a Hercules 40 or provocation intended for young Morgelli. He was to be arrested as a spy and given full treatment. A tribunal was handed down the maximum sentence for espionage. Morgelli's counsel and the Swiss authorities would certainly intervene, which was just what Schellenberg wanted. In this way, he could force Roger Masson to come to Germany. The ruse worked perfectly, for as Schellenberg had suspected, Morgelli had been carried out a minor secret assignment. He supplied certain information concerning the Wehrmacht's movements in areas adjoining the Swiss frontier. One evening in a brasserie in Stuttgart, Morgelli made the acquaintance of a German civilian who confided that he was a staunch anti-Nazi. Morgelli was impudent enough to say that he shared his views, thus falling for a trick of infantile simplicity. He was arrested on the spot and condemned to death. The terrified consul immediately informed Bern, which passed the message on to Masson in Lucerne, asking him if he could intervene. Masson had immediately agreed, and on September 8, 1942, Schellenberg and Masson would meet at last. Okay, that's it for today. We're coming up on the 13th chapter, but you see what you don't see in the movies about World War II, and you don't hear many books talking about a lot of this stuff, and how really the Third Reich was destined to collapse because of all of this. This is spying on the inside, and so one guy and 10 high-ranking officers in the high command were really responsible for the end of the Third Reich. And that's why this kind of work is so important. But I've noticed in the right wing, I used to try to develop intelligence operations in the right wing. Forget it. They don't get it. They're not into cloak and dagger. They just don't understand it. They think you got to approach every battle with the front. You know, bam, here we are. We're going to tromp on you. But most battles are won by spying and intelligence operations. You win the battle before it's even fought. But I never could get that through to right wingers. Well, I mean, you know, a few understood it, but we could never get anything going about in. You know, like with the skinheads, I told the ones that were smart to get out of being a skinhead, go to college, get a good career, and then you'll be ready to do some good work for our struggle. I don't know how many did, but I don't think it was very many of them. Most of them wanted to stick to the old-fashioned way of, look at me, I got a shaved head and a swastika tattooed on my forehead. So the right wing will never win this battle. So if you think you're going to stick with the right wing and win this battle, forget it. They don't have the brains to do it. They're not sneaky enough. And also, they're the kind that says, well, I won't use that tactic because that's my enemy uses that tactic, so I wouldn't do that. 14-5, I'll see you tomorrow, maybe. Yeah, we'll see. 14-5. And the other reason why none of that stuff went very far, in closing here, is because you tell young guys to try to train them, and then they go to some of these right-wing racial leaders that got these groups, you know who they are, and they'd say, well, Metzger said this, and we ought to do that. And they, of course, these guys are all jealous of their position and their ability to take in money and the whole bit. Oh, that Metzger, you don't know what the hell he's talking about. He's probably working for the CIA.